This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 28th of December, 1951. The title of this lecture is The Life Continuum Theory. This lecture is 61 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
I'm going to start the gun rolling now on an interesting, fabulous, colossal, unprecedented phenomena, which is just about as fascinating to watch as a five-ring circus. Let's give it the very staid name of the life continuum theory. The life continuum theory. It's a bit more than a theory. It has phenomena accompanying it which go crunch. Anyone here who has had terrific difficulty in resolving a case in himself or in others has been crushing his skull into the life continuum theory and attendant phenomena. So you better know this one. The life continuum theory probably has several explanations. I do not wish at this time to tell you that the explanation is this or is that. I will just give you several explanations for it, because you'll find out that sometimes it works out one way and sometimes it works out another way. Then there's undoubtedly a central explanation for this manifestation. But I cannot tell you at this moment, I'm very sorry for it, I apologize, exactly what that is. It's going to be probably days before we know. The point is that an individual tends to carry on the fears, goals, habits, tokens, manifestations of the failed, the departed, or the dead. You know, it's be a considerable joke on the cynics of the past if we were to discover that our primary motivation, each and every one of us, was to help. If survive was best interpreted by each individual in terms of you will survive, not I will. That would be very interesting, wouldn't it? I don't say that this is the case, but I do know this, that you can persuade individuals to get well and get up on their feet solely to help somebody else when they will not do it for themselves. And I know this, that an individual will run engrams, secondaries, somatics, stand on his head, hang out the window, climb the Woolworth building or anything else rather than run out and conclude and end a life continuum in which he is engaged. And whenever, in a case, whenever you have come up to a point where this individual is, he's just plain not resolving on something, you've run up against life continuum. The immediate miracle occurs when the individual is not engaged very heavily on life continuum, and when you can get to, accidentally or otherwise, his decision to be sick and run something off the incident, little emotion, anything, I don't care what it is, we'll just go by the boards. But if he is holding this in trust for a person who is departed, failed, or dead, he won't give it up until you process it very properly and very correctly. As I look through this room here, I see a few pairs of glasses. I can tell you that in every case, those glasses are being held for somebody who is departed, failed, or dead. That's all there is to it. You take this person's goals, and you said this person will live. And this person goes on living, evidently, as long as you hold a somatic or the habit for them. I knew about this manifestation in July of 1950. But I didn't know the depths it extended. And I definitely, at that time, was trying to lash it in by itself. But another whole series of phenomena presented themselves suddenly, abruptly, and could not be ignored. That's the phenomenon of a past death. Fascinating stuff. Somebody comes up to you and says, "Do you believe in a past death?" Well, I can tell you this. It's simply this. A past death is discoverable by effort processing any time you want to run the effort within the effort within the effort. You start a fellow out, what is the effort not to see? What is the effort to have that effort not to see? Just running back down the line like this. All right, what is the effort to have that effort now? Now, what's the effort to have that effort? Now, what's the effort not to have that effort? All right, what's the effort to have that effort? And the first thing you know, there he is lying at Antietam or Shiloh or with the children all standing around on a farm in Sicily. And you haven't said a doggone word about past deaths. And there he lies. And he tells you all about it. If you didn't run it, and if you just busily invalidated it and said, "Oh, well, it can't be such a thing," he'd go into a state of collapse on you. When they get invalidated, the person goes pretty bad on. We're not dealing with belief in this regard. We're dealing with something that's very concrete. It's phenomena. And on investigation, this phenomena turns out to be very phenomenal. Now, one of the little tricks that you can pull on an individual, I'm getting ready to duck right now because there's probably a gentleman in the audience who, if he has a tomato in his pocket, would throw it. You say to somebody, they say, "Well, past death genetic blueprint, you know, and so forth, doesn't say anything about that, and William James..." So immediately you say, "Well, we're not interested too much in that." Let the conversation drag for a little while, and then all of a sudden ask him, "Can you imagine a clam?" Now, I told a couple of fellows exactly what the manifestations would be if you ask a person this question. They are as follows. The person begins to feel sympathetic. He begins to feel sad. And so forth. People don't feel sad over clams. Then pretty soon he'll do some kind of a valence shift. And his jaw's hinges will begin to hurt. And he'll feel kind of bad about the whole thing. If you don't run it out, it'll hang with him for a while. But you haven't told him anything. All you say to him is, "Can you imagine a clam that is going this way? Kind of fast?" See, unfortunately, that's the death throes of a clam. They can't writhe this way. They can only flap. So somebody that asks you something about this and you feel sort of ornery that night and you say, "You know this past death thing you've been talking about?" And can you imagine a clam? Because they'll move over and get inside that clam. Eventually, they'll see it exteriorized. They'll pick it up on its death, and then they move over and they get inside the thing. And then they start talking about the poor clam. Because the clam on the genetic blueprint line happens to be what you are now using for jaws. in the roof and floor of your mouth. And that's the hinges, and that's the first bivalve. And that's, they came out of the sea, and this bivalve stage occurred about in there, and it was a very static state. A clam is not mobile, believe me. He does not go very far, and he gets rather impatient, and the whole thing is a sort of a series of holders. It's a mean spot on the track. But how come we're running the death of the clam? That does not put it on the genetic line. You mean this clam did this and then got some new clams? No, it didn't. All I'm telling you about now is phenomena. You can believe what you please. You take a person with a terrific toothache. Evidently, after a clam got kicked out on the beach, the sun blazed down. The type of mollusk which is on this line evidently had spores or barnacles which were around on its upper lip, inside. It evidently procreated more or less in this fashion. Anyway, here were these things up there. And the sun blazed down. And these things were tight sealed. They weren't dead yet, but the clam was. And the sun blazes down, and all of a sudden, these things do the strangest thing. You wouldn't expect a tooth to do this. Explode. The gas pressure inside that inner barnacle, or that will become a tooth someday, goes, and they spatter. And there's a somatic for each cell in there as it's dying, and then there's a bow. And you take somebody who has one of these terrific toothaches, you ask them, what's the matter with your tooth? Oh, it just feels like it's going to blow up. And goes and ties it all up and tries to hold it down. So forth, and you say, can you imagine yourself being inside that tooth and then just suddenly shattering? And the person says, yes. That's the way it feels. And you say, all right, do so. He said, why even get a sort of a sound? Do it a few times. Do it a few times. Do it a few times. Where's your toothache? God. Fascinating. Dentists are always talking about teeth bursting. Great restimulator. The toughest nerve, one might say, in the body, and probably the oldest nerve, what they call the fifth nerve, right around there. Now, when you start monkeying with one side of this nerve, a lot of other points on the nerve go by the boards. You get sympathy from one tooth to the other tooth. You get explosions for all these teeth. Now, there's another manifestation. The clamshell goes crunch, and there was a piece of sand over here. And it comes down on these little soft spores that will become teeth someday. Bang! And it's quite a somatic. But you can get a person to run those out when he has a toothache. Why, he feels better. I mean, it's gone. The tooth has a tendency to rehabilitate as long as it isn't in sympathy for some dead tooth. It's mourning for the dead. Why is it that when you get one tooth pulled, the next tooth to it goes boom? Well, you can say, well, it's laid it in an engram and there's a holder there and so forth. That's complicated. Because it doesn't resolve on that. But it resolves on, let's see, can you imagine yourself being a tooth feeling sorry for another tooth just as that tooth gets pulled? The person says, yeah. Yeah, I can do that. Now, can you feel sympathy? I see. Yes. The tooth will rehabilitate. The tooth is a pretty bad experiment on the genetic line. People have trouble with them. They have to get pulled out all the time and all that sort of thing. Yeah, it's an auditor. If you want to monkey with this on effort processing, you can do a great deal of work with this. Because here is your first interpersonal relationship. This hinge and this hinge together, see, on this hinge and this hinge, bow, they come down. See? They're not in agreement with each other. This one tries to open, and this one wants to stay closed. Well, there's a battle to find out who's boss. And eventually they find out who's boss. One goes into apathy, and the other one after that. They're very happy about the whole thing. Then they find out that even then they have trouble. So they did something that the United States and Russia ought to do. They moved the government of Russia into the United States and the government of the United States into Russia. Now, anytime you have that sort of a situation happening, you're not going to get any fights. That's approximately what you got. You can actually go back down along the channel with effort processing and straighten up and rehabilitate this control area into this side of the body and this control area into this side of the body and fix it up so an individual doesn't have strokes or anything of the sort. You just get this one clear across and control, this one clear across and control. You'll find yourself running an awful lot of engrams in order to do it, but you get this cross-communication line resolved, and an individual feels a lot more comfortable afterwards. Because many places along the lines, they're hung up and they're not resolved. Now, we're talking about control centers. There's your most serious conflict on the control center line. You start monkeying around with control centers, you're liable to find yourself back along this line someplace. Now, I just take a straight memory on each time I was flapping my hand and talking about the clam. Pick them both up. Three of them. Interesting business. We do the same thing with any kind of effort processing. As a matter of fact, somebody has got to go back along the line and just with effort processing locate the manifestation that was back of each one of these epicenters and conflicts. You could take almost any pre-clear that worked fairly easily. You could go trace them easily. You could find out what it was. For instance, once upon a time, the arms terminated here. And once they terminated here, then here. In other words, at some time or other, each one of these centers was the extremity. And at some time or other, practically every epicenter was itself the boss. At some time or other, each one has been the boss. And just as a ship will disintegrate when it gets each department out of coordination with every other department, so will the body disintegrate when you start getting control centers abdicating. This arm decides it's not going to coordinate anymore with this arm, and there you get lack of sports coordination and so forth. It's fascinating. But you do this with effort processing. You don't do this by suggesting it to somebody. You don't have to suggest anything. You just start getting the effort within the effort to do the effort to something or other. Can you feel any communication along that line? No. Yes, we can feel communication. All of a sudden, sharp somatic will go on and off, something like that. It's interesting that at every point of termination of an organism, the individual goes out of valence, and there's your basic valence mechanism. Death. Out. Death up. You can run these and run these and run these in individuals. So we're not talking about whether or not we're running a flock of past deaths or whether we're running our own past deaths or the past deaths of somebody else or anything else. Whether we're running, doesn't matter what we're running. It happens that that's the phenomena. You can argue with the phenomena just like you could argue with your right hand against the radiator of a Mack truck in low gear. Unless you take account of it as an auditor, you are going to find some of your pre-clears as you do effort processing to them way back down the time track saying, it's so funny, I feel like I have claws. You know, I felt like that half my life. I've got claws here. You know, I very often got claws here. And you get him, get the effort to let go. No! Well, now, come on, just get the effort to let go. Get the effort not to let go then. Bonk! Because if you work on him for a short time, he'll fall. The reason he won't let go is he's hanging onto a tree with claws. See? And he's got himself suspended. And he's been hanging there for a long time. and it's 8,000 feet down to the bottom of the ravine, and he knows he's skidding, and the bark is slipping, and he's been trying to hold on now for a few eons, and all of a sudden you come along, and you fix it up so he can't hold on anymore. And if you really fix him up so he can't hold on anymore, he will fall, and you will watch him fall right there on the couch. When you have run people through falls, you've generally stopped them midway, so they are still in the air, because the mind has the perfect belief that it can stop time. So it can in the mind, but not in the physical universe. So here's your individual, be lying on the couch in certain ways, certain attitudes. He'll twist in certain ways. He's trying to do something about a fall, perhaps. And if he's telling you about this fall he makes, and you can process this part of the fall and that part of the fall and this part of the fall and that part of the fall, you're just not getting any place with this fall unless you watch him fall. And you can see him let go. And he'll hit. And then you can run out the rest of the engram. You have to run on all sorts of parts of it. They try to hold themselves midair, in other words. But that particular form I was telling you about is a sloth. Sloth. Sloth's awful dumb. You see, they're dumb. Tarsus. Something like that. Liable to come around along and run into a tree limb. Bonk. 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 All of a sudden say, there's something hitting me. And then look up and go through the terrible worry of trying to figure out he wants to go up the tree and the limb is in the road, and trying to get the solution of how you go up the tree without the limb, and occasionally abandoning the whole thing and going down the tree and climbing another tree. Rather than move just that far and miss the limb. Sloths are also very stupid. They go backing off of things. Tarsus, oh gee, this is fascinating. If you want to just fool around with scientific investigation, boy, could you louse up a preclear. You could go back and find this type of life form and that type of life form and this effort and that effort and other efforts and fool around and fool around. You can go back to photon conversion. All sorts of things. Doesn't matter much what you do about it. There's a lot of work there lying for somebody. They'll be done someday. But it's just literally, there's your thousands of hours of auditing. Of course, the preclear realizes that all the efforts and counter-efforts have been run out, clear all the way back down the track, and he goes, he disappears, of course. Because all you're composed of, actually, are just efforts and counter-efforts. But every effort you have was at one time or another a counter-effort, so what are you composed of? You're composed of counter-efforts. So after you've run out all the counter-efforts on a case, from one end of the case to the other, your preclear should vanish. Be interesting. My scientific experimental nature sometimes toys with the idea. But I haven't picked a candidate yet. Now, at each one of these periods of cessation of a life form, there are several manifestations occur mentally. You run out some effort or emotion on the line. Effort, emotion on the line. Postulates begin to show up. And you will find out that a thought comes before all thoughts, but each thought is derived from every past thought. In other words, there is the prime thought, which has nothing earlier. But then there are thoughts from here on out which are derived from efforts, counter-efforts, efforts. They create new thoughts. But the thought itself is what holds the whole thing together. The whole package is in suspension with thought. All right, you run a past death down to the point where you get thoughts coming out, and you'll find that these thoughts are very interesting. They consist of I wish I were somewhere else. I'll pretend I'm somewhere else. I'm really not here at all. I am not here. I'm going on. My life is elsewhere. I shouldn't have been here. I deeply regret this whole thing. In other words, it's an effort to cancel out the whole incident and somehow keep going. And you quite often run down a thought chain with an individual and find them lying someplace in a pile of rocks or something of the sort. They tell you this, you don't, and they say, well, here I am wishing I could keep on going somehow. In spite of being here, I wish I keep on going. Well, it's a holder. He says, in spite of being here, I wish I could keep on going. So he sort of carries these somatics along. He sort of postulates a new body for himself, something of the sort. Now, whether or not, the only reason I'm telling you all this is because you're going to run into it. I can't do anything about it. I wish I could pass a law or something and say this won't obtain anymore. It isn't a case of believing in. It's a phenomena which you will discover. And as you discover it, you had better know how to handle it. I would not take this phenomena and describe it to your preclear. I wouldn't fool with this. I mean, I wouldn't coax him into any of this because he could start using it for one thing as a dodge mechanism. Another thing, he can get so engrossed because it's very interesting that he forgets all about present time and he sort of does an automatic reversal on himself. He introverts to the extremity of wondering who he was where and who the dame was and where he went and did he really go to the ball that night. And if he hadn't ordered the gun fired at that time, then would he still be alive? And he starts worrying about who won. I've seen this come up. Who won? Like you say, well, let's get back. But who won? And you say, well, what was the name of the battle again? And he says, well, just a minute. Goes through it. Yeah, he says, that's right. Shiloh, who won? And you say, the Union. I don't believe it. You can get yourself into some interesting situations like this. You can also back a boy all the way up to number one. First motion, first impact. Now, if we were all from the same life static, theoretically, you run out the first impact, it'd run out for everybody. But I've run several people, and it isn't run out in them. Each new person has a new first impact, so it kind of looks different. It's an interesting problem. Something you get bogged down in very easily. But it's phenomena. And as phenomena, demands the attention of the auditor. And by the auditor's code, the auditor must not evaluate for the preclear. I merely tell you that your preclear is not insane because he believes at this moment that he's just got through getting an arrow through his midriff. He's not insane. He probably has an arrow through his midriff. Unless you run out this arrow through his midriff or get him off onto something else, so what? Very interesting. You must know that this can happen to your preclear. Otherwise, you're going to get him in trouble. And I'm not here trying to sell you the idea that there are past lives or that reincarnation is the stuff or anything of the sort. This is a phenomenon. Let me insist on that about 8 more times. Now, we've understood that I've insisted on it that many more times. Now, go on to life continuum. Now, what is life continuum? It is a re-stimulation of an individual's desire to go on living when he's dying. Is that it? Well, that could be one explanation. Is it a key-in of some old past death of his own? When he sees somebody die, that could be an explanation. Do these life continuums fail to come up just because you haven't run out the proper past deaths of the preclear? Well, however that may be, awful lot of preclears, you're not going to take the glasses off of or the arthritis away from or anything else unless you solve life continuum. And it is simply this. Somebody fails, departs, or dies, and the individual then takes on the burden of this person's habits and goals, fears, and idiosyncrasies. These are sometimes very easy to resolve, and sometimes they're very hard to resolve. Now, you take somebody Well, here's the last one I ran into. It was rather amusing and resolved in about 3 minutes. Person had been putting an ointment on her nose with a... had been getting a little sore on her nose and been putting ointment on it and was trying to ignore it, but every time she forgot the salve, why, this little sore would come back. And I said, well, do you know anybody else had a sore nose? Moment of thought. Yes, my father. Say, don't scare. Well, did your father ever worry about his nose? Yes. Matter of fact, I remember him standing, looking at himself in the mirror. I said, what'd you think? I thought to myself, if he'd just ignore it, it would be all right. And, well, what was he doing for it? Well, I don't know what he's doing for that, but I know what I'm doing for this one. I put this salve cuticura on it. Now, what kind of salve did he put on it? Thought. All of a sudden, big line charge, cuticura. That sealed the bargain, and there went the sore nose. The spot disappeared, about the biggest quarter, disappeared within a half an hour. Gone. Person had been holding on to this life continuum, holding on to this idea. I doubt that there's a person in this room who isn't busily holding on to something for somebody who's dead, departed, or failed. When I say departed, I mean just simply that. Now, this is the liability of the ally. Each one of these people that you're holding for is an ally. In this handbook for pre-clears, it sorts these people out quite a little bit. But you can do a lot more with this life continuum than just that. There's a lot to it. You find this individual says, well, you know somebody used to want to make people happy. No, nobody in my family. Well, how about a pet? How about a dog? Yeah, I had a dog once. Well, did that dog want to make people happy? Yes. All of a sudden, you realize you've hit something with this person because they're sort of wincing and jolting a little bit. You discover it just a little bit further, you explore it just a little bit further. What else does a dog like to do? What does a dog like to eat? Let's find out a few more things about what dogs like to do. We've already noticed that our pre-clears... Now, one of two things can happen. Either this dog all of a sudden blows just by being recognized, or it has to be processed out on the basis of sympathy, blame, and regret on the death or departure of this pet. You're actually processing what the individual is dubbing in for the dog somatic. The individual dubs this in out of his own bank for the dog somatic. And then you run this somatic and then he'll get another somatic, and you can run that one, and you can run another one, and you can run another one. The mechanism you're working with is the mechanism of dubbing in something for the dog. And he has an unlimited supply of chronic somatics. And as long as that dog is there having to be continued in life for, the preclear will just take more and more chronic somatics and substitute them for this dog. He'll find other things that dogs do. So, it can get pretty bad sometimes. You start examining the number of deaths and failures there have been around an individual, and you will discover the number of people, potentially, for whom he is carrying a life continuum. Sometimes they're carrying it for a little baby. They felt something for a little brother, or something. A little brother died maybe when he was only 8, 9 months old, or a little sister. And you'll find out some weird computation on the order, well, the reason I have to be inactive and do nothing is because that's what a baby does. That's why I drink all that milk. And now, a life continuum, however, has other mechanisms involved in it. A person must have wished approval from the individual, must have wanted approval from this individual whose life he's continuing. You can find moments when he wanted their approval. Must have regretted their death. And must have felt defensive for the departed individual toward the rest of the family. This person, no matter how tiny this individual was when this happened, is the defender for the person who eventually dies. And he goes on defending on the basis of, you see, I can have all these bad habits, and I'm living. Therefore, this person was right. Well, how do you, what's the advantage of making a person right? You bring them back to life. If a person is wrong, they're dead. Then there's blame, there's regret. You start running just blame, regret, shame, approval, desire to contribute to, various lines like that on one of these allies, and it'll blow up for the character. The whole death will blow up. That is, say, it'll blow out. But unless you do it on this regret, blame, do you remember blaming yourself for this death? No, I couldn't have blamed myself for my grandpappy's death. I just couldn't have done it. Let's run regret on your grandfather. What do you mean, run regret? Well, can you feel a feeling of regret in present time? Well, I guess so, faintly. Well, all right, let's just run the feeling of regret on the subject of grandfather. But on what specific incident? Well, you got a Vizio of him any place? Yes, I got one Vizio of grandfather. It's got a very good Vizio. Well, just run regret off that Vizio. All of a sudden, more data blows in. We'll just run some more regret. More regret. Ooh, it was my fault that he died. Something like that blows out. Run out that feelings, conditions, and so on. You'll also find there was an enormous amount of approval desired from grandfather. And there was also a terrific desire to contribute to grandfather and an inability to do so. All of this. And by running these various things and running the thought chain of, well, I ought to defend him and you can't talk about my grandfather that way and he's all right, and the thought chain of, well, I'd like to be like him. He's big and strong. You get the combination. I mean, it's any part of any of these combinations. You see how those combinations are. It's just a sympathy line between grandpa, all the component parts that sympathy is made out of, contribution, desire for approval, and all of this, the grandpa. You just run this up the line. If you can't get any Vizio on something, just always run regret. If you can't really find out anything, get the emotional, counter-emotion of grandfather. Remember when your grandfather felt happy? I can vaguely get an idea. Well, when did he feel sad? Oh, he wasn't sad, he was drunk. Well, you get the counter-emotion of your grandfather drunk? Ding, 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 ding. Yes. I got a Vizio of not run regret. Now, all of a sudden, this stuff starts blowing into view. Here's the way you pick the lock on the occluded individual, the occluded case, or the wide-open case where the whole track from one end to the other is dubbing. A person whose whole track is dubbing, one of these terrific dubbing cases, is so full of regret that they have moved not only to occlusion, but to complete dubbing. If you want to see what dubbing is, get somebody who is relatively occluded in your own case, anybody who's a little bit occluded, and get the Vizios on the stories they told you. You'll find out you might not be able to see the person who's telling the stories, but you can get the Vizio on the stories they're telling. See how that'd be? So the solution of this, by the way, you just run regret on those stories. Just run regret on those Vizios. And the next thing you know, this person will blow into view, or at least turn black. You see, that's much preferable than having a phony picture. And you just run it a little bit more, and you get it off, and the next thing you know, why, you've got your case set up. Now, whatever this mechanism of past death is, I don't know. I didn't invent it. And nobody, by merely saying it doesn't exist, is going to banish the phenomena. It's not a subject for argument. It's simply a subject for the auditor to be alert on. That's all. It may be some source for this life continuum. But believe me, life continuum is nothing very unsolid. Oh, man, can you demonstrate life continuum to an individual? If you want to shake your preclear right down to the depths of his soul, you just start monkeying around with life continuum. Run regret off, the feeling of regret off a few visios which he has that he is always sort of worried about, but there they are. He'll hand you the whole computation on his case if you start doing this, and then run some blame. Who'd you blame it on? And so on. He'll come back into control of enough facsimiles to think on this subject. Who'd you blame it on? Blaming is handing over the facsimile to somebody else, or even handing the facsimile over to some part of your own body so that you as an I can control it. Anyway, blame, regret, just run it on this case for a little while. The first thing you know, he'll start telling you all about how he's so guilty because of what he did to... Or he'll start telling you, oh, my poor dear grandmother, I didn't help her enough. I should have done more for her while she was alive, and now that she's dead, I can't help her anymore. And so on and so on and so on and so on. You say, what would you say Grandma's goals were? And he'll give you the character description of his aberrated self. You find some poor guy who's busily being a salesman. He's not a good salesman. He's not a bad salesman. He's just busy being a salesman. But he's a failure at it, really. He hasn't picked himself up by his bootstraps through salesmanship, and he's always sort of thought on the side that what he really wanted to do was build model trains or something. Manufacture them, something along this line. Big ideas, but he gets over on these ideas very occasionally. You start asking him, who wanted to be a salesman in your family? Oh, nobody. I was thinking again, is there anybody who's dead that wanted to be a salesman in your family? Oh, nobody but my father. All right, let's pick up the times when you defended your father to your mother or the rest of the family about salesmanship. Oh, I couldn't remember anything like that. No. Just run some regret on your father. Oh, yeah, there was a time. Yeah, there was a time, by George, and they were awful mad at him. He'd worked all summer, and he'd sold all these things and so on, and I said that, yeah, I said they shouldn't pick on him that way, and, you blame yourself for your father's death? Oh, well, yes. Yes, well, how do you blame yourself for your father's death? What did you do that caused your father to die? Well, nothing very specific. Well, what did happen? Well, he was out in the field one day, and he was cranking the tractor, and all of a sudden he leaned his hand on the radiator, and I said, are you all right? And he said, yeah, I'm all right. And I said, is there anything wrong with you? Well, heart kicks up once in a while. And I made up my mind right then to tell my mother and some of the neighbors to try to keep an eye on him, but you know I didn't. And maybe if I'd told the neighbors at that time, why, he might have lived a few years longer. There's just some tricky thing in my mind that kept me from telling my mother about that, and I don't know what that could possibly be. And you say, well, you're guilty then to some degree? Well, yes, I am. Well, let's see now. Let's pick up the number of times that your father, or sometime or other, your father told you you'd better not worry your mother. Oh, that. Oh, yes. Yes, not to tell my mother about this, not to tell my mother about that, not to tell my mother. You know, that was why I didn't tell her that, because, well, what do you know?
I'm not guilty of my father's death.
Because you see, every individual considers himself fully responsible, inherently and natively, all the way down through all the dynamics. Everyone does. Inherently, basically, there isn't a person in this room who doesn't basically consider himself responsible all across the boards. And who's not having trouble with having to keep the world sort of compartmented off so that he doesn't have to realize that he's really responsible for it. That's true, isn't it? I mean, how can you feel yourself guilty, for instance, for the death of some animal if you're not originally feel that you're responsible for the animal? What's blame? Blame is a negation of your responsibility. You can blame self, that's the last stage. Or you can blame somebody else. That's an effort not to be responsible. Here's this little boy, and he's felt that he's responsible for his father's death. Well, that means he's responsible for his father natively. And by the way, this really starts to pick up in processing. You can actually meter an individual's progress up the tone scale by the degree of his responsibility across all the dynamics. He comes up the tone scale, he gets into these various degrees of responsibility, various spheres. And what is one of the commonest manifestations of aberration? At low levels, you'll find that an aberrated individual will not take any responsibility. Okay, get rid of it. Pick up the rug. Sweep it under. At anger, a person that thinks that he is being forced to take responsibility that he does not want. No, he's not being fully responsible. You take a person who's very cheerful, happy, enthusiastic about life in general, and you suddenly start challenging them about this and that and so forth, and you can't upset them very much. Why? Why, shucks, they've already taken responsibility for you, too. Now, evidently, you can't just go around and say, I'll be fully responsible for everybody and everything and so on, and I'll be responsible from here on out. But it's very interesting that if you want to put something across, let us say in a sales conversation or to somebody, let's take a relative that you normally quarrel with, and you're going to have to talk to this person. How if you say to yourself just before you talk to him, well, I'm responsible for everything they say anyhow. I'm responsible for them. It's weird. They do what you tell them to do. I started out some little time ago to try to solve interpersonal relations. I said, let's solve interpersonal relations. So we got some interesting stuff. First thing that turned up was black Dianetics on interpersonal relations. How do you drive somebody crazy quick? With an emotional curve. I take the emotional curve, you know, and you build a guy way up to the top of this curve and then drop him in the least possible time as low as you can on the curve. And the way you do this is by using any button, any of the 12 buttons. You bring him up as high on that button as you can bring him and then drop him suddenly on the emotional curve. And you get a very interesting reaction. He'll go into doldrums. He may go commit suicide. You can do it quick, fast. You can do it on cause and effect this way. You can say, you know that preclear you were treating? You know, the other night, you know, the preclear you were treating and so on, you worked on quite a bit and so on, and you were working over and to get rid of everything she's doing, and you know it was very good processing you did there. And remember, everybody in the room was so satisfied with the way you were doing the job. And I says, yes. She's in the hospital, and she says, you did it. It doesn't matter even whether it's true or not. If you said, well, she shot herself last night and the parents say you did it. She shot herself last night and the parents said you did it. I mean, that fixes them right up. They might not even bother to ascertain what happened. Now, of course, as I say, that's dropping the emotional curve on an individual. You can do that on any button. You can elect a person up the scale to how much he knows, and then prove to him he doesn't know. And you can elect him up the scale into being a fine cause, and then demonstrate that he's really just a low-level effect. You can pull him up the scale on his state of beingness. Women do this quite a bit. In state of beingness, they say, "Oh, my dear, how well you look in that hat. I've always liked it." Here's the individual, then, with blame and so forth, and he desires to contribute. I'm going to take a whole hour off to tell you about approval, because it's right in there dead center. But the individual tries hard for a while to be responsible for everything, and then he sort of dwindles down the line. He gets responsible for less and less and less and less and less, and he starts blaming after a while, and giving away responsibility after a while, and he gives away more and more and more and more responsibility. And he just comes down the end of the line, and he isn't responsible for anything. He's finished. Now, he does that fast whenever he picks up a life continuum, because somebody dies to whom he wanted to contribute, that he wanted the approval of, that he felt regret for, that he blames himself for the death for, that he defends against the family. All of these conditions answered, and he'll carry on their life, only he'll carry on their life just exactly as they looked at life. So you'll have an individual who's apparently, and is reacting as though he were down around 0.5 on the tone scale, and he'd be limping along at 0.5, and he'd be having a heck of a time, and you just ask him these questions and winnow it out, and he'll come back up, and all of a sudden is himself. He really isn't even, it is not a question even of valence. He's just taken on all these goals. All the goals, the fears, the desires, the deformities, and everything else of the departed and the dead. Great stuff. At what moment does he decide to do that? First moment he decided to emulate them. First moment he decided to be like them in his life. The first moment he decided he liked them. And the first moment he had to defend them, regardless of their age. And he picks up these things, and out they go. Now, as you pick up these things in processing, you could see remarkable changes in some preclears. And sometimes a case won't even start to resolve unless you pick up this thing. I mean, it's just stuck, that's all. The fellow is just being Grandpa or Aunt Emma or somebody, and he's just being this person, that's all. And maybe he's being a lot of people and having a lot of trouble trying to reconcile all this. But why won't he give it up right away? When you find a person, for instance, is ill, particularly because of a life continuum, when you find that he's ill because of this, you really have to search around sometimes to get him to release it. And sometimes you'll find his case wide open up to the moment when you decide to run out the death of the person whose life he's continuing. And at that moment, he will shut off all of his perceptics and everything else and go completely blotto. This has happened, evidently. Isn't that interesting? What's an occluded case? You can put it bluntly and say, well, he doesn't want to get well. The nasty fellow will slap him in the wrist. Or you can tackle it intelligently and say, what blame and regret, contribution and so forth that must we get off of this case in order to spring the death that has all this shut up on it? Sometimes we have to even spring the postulate first. The first postulate is, well, I don't want to see it, don't want to hear it, don't want to do any of these things, and so forth. Why? He hasn't even got an evaluation as to why he postulated these things. But there, if anywhere, is where your auditor's going to have to use some good horse sense. I don't care if you know effort processing and you know how to run old-time engrams or old-time secondaries or anything else. You're not going to get Grandpa's death unless you get away and get rid of the life continuum. In other words, we've resolved what this gimmick was.
This holder on and the cluder on deaths. Find times when they defended the person who's dead. They find times when they wanted the approval of the person who's dead. You find times when the individual felt sympathetic for the person who was dead, or failed even. And you find, in particular, the blame and regret for the departure, the failure, or the death. And you understand that a little kid's nurse can simply leave. And ever afterwards, at a comedy moment or some moment when he's even sad, right, he'll start talking with a Norwegian accent. Why? Well, he's going on being this nurse. You take somebody who is very plump. They're maybe being plump not because they're stuck in birth. They stick themselves in birth so they can be plump for the departed nurse. See? Simple. Simple mechanism. You just use these facsimiles any way you want to use them. They're your facsimiles. And you can do the damnedest things with them. And that's amongst the various things you can do with them, is this dub in a complete set of life continuum. Now, the main, large, horrendous improvement in all this, auditing and so forth, is now the auditor has the ability to pick apart this. He's got to be a little bit clever in that he's got to recognize that if Grandpa wore glasses and the preclear wears glasses, and the glasses don't immediately surrender, that it's probably life continuum. Now, it's life continuum, so therefore, this person is blaming somebody, blaming himself, or blaming somebody else for the death of a person. He has defended this person. He has continued the role of this person. And the actual somatics of this other individual aren't there. They're not to be run, but the preclear has dubbed in a flock of them, and you won't even be able to touch those darn somatics. There they are. You keep running this, that. The preclear will run anything for you. He's happy. He'll run everything down the track this way and up the track that way and back and forth and so forth. But will he stop continuing the life of Grandpa? Oh, no. See, he's got to, because he was responsible for it. That's one of them. See, there are various reasons that lie around behind this. A lot of nice reasons. I'll make you a bet in the last few minutes that I've been talking in. There were several people who suddenly realized they were doing a life continuum. Let's see a show of hands, how many there are. Holy smokes. Now, that's why I say, when somebody asked me here with a note, you say you can run off the emotion off a case in a few hours. Yeah. Because you don't have to bleed these secondaries. That's what we're going to talk about tomorrow. We're going to talk about the right to survive. We're going to talk about the handling of the unit facsimile. Why bleed these facsimiles? Why try to take anything out of them? Let's just disconnect them so the individual can handle them as he pleases. And that doesn't take very long. And the other one, sort of, is like distrusting the convict. You say, now we're going to fix up your facsimiles, so there's just plain nothing in any of them that can trouble you. This is actually an authoritative type of thing. We're not giving you back control of your facsimiles. We're just fixing up your facsimiles so they can't trouble you. See, we're doing a facsimileectomy. Now, what we're interested in is rehabilitating the individual's ability to handle his own facsimiles. That's all. And when you've completely rehabilitated an individual's ability to do this, why, where else can you go? Unless you start suddenly discovering these upper levels of control centers and be able to yank people out through the top if that's desirable. In short, there is the end of processing. Tomorrow we will talk again about approval, which is really just the right to survive, and the handling of facsimiles, and some other items pertinent to all this. Thank you very much for your bright and smiling faces. I'll see you tomorrow.